Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made Birmingham, Alabama, the epicenter of the civil rights era? And are there as many lessons in the savage and cowardly events that took place there as in the noble and courageous ones? Although she grew up in Birmingham in the 1960s, much of what Diane McWhorter learned about that crucible of the American struggle for civil rights came decades later, when she returned to her childhood home as a journalist, looking to understand her own family's history and the legacy of growing up in one of the most turbulent times and places in 20th century America. She will speak about the experience at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's Martin Luther King Symposium on January 19th. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning book about that is now available in paperback. It is called Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. Diane, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So often, if it's a white Southerner who grows up and writes a book like this, they report having a sort of Atticus Finch parental figure, somebody who was a model of tolerance for the time, and so therefore they grew up sort of understanding all of this in a very different way. That was not the case with your family.
That's right. I always think that a friend of mine who grew up in one of the liberal Jewish families in town once said to me, Diane, you don't remember hearing about the church being bombed? And I said, no. And she goes, that's crazy. I said, well, that's why I had to write this book and you didn't. I grew up in a really typical sort of white supremacist family. What was atypical about my branch of the family was that my father was, who had been born into the country club and was the son of Ivy League educated parents, was very downwardly mobile and kind of hung out at beer joints, and he used the N-word, which polite white people did not use around their children. I found out later that they actually did when they were out of earshot, just as they swore when they weren't around us. But you know, other than that, we were, you know, he was sort of on the extreme end of, at least certainly speech-wise, of the racist spectrum. But otherwise, you know, we were pretty typical for our time and place.
What made you decide to go back and look more closely at the events in the 1960s? Was this volume of a series about the 50 states, and your editor at the time tossed Alabama at you and said you might want this? Can you talk a little bit about what happened when you finally opened it up?
Yeah, I'd gone to my grandmother's alma mater, Wellesley College, outside of Boston, and at the time of the counterculture, and I just very rapidly shed all my markers of, you know, the Birmingham childhood. And so I was writing for an alternative paper in Boston called the Boston Phoenix, and went in reviewing, been a literature major and started reviewing books, was the way I got my start in writing. And so I remember going into the office one time, and the book review editor sort of gave me this Alabama volume of a 50 book series on this United States, on the 50 states, published as part of the bicentennial in 1976. Anyway, he sort of like, you know, held it out to me like it had cooties and said, you know, get this off my shelf. And I took it in the spirit in which it was offered, because as I said, at that point I pretty much rejected everything about the South and had actually thought I would end up being like an expatriate in France or something before I would go back south. But I didn't throw the book away. And I guess it was several years later that I was getting ready to go home for a visit and got it off the shelf and started reading about Birmingham. And I had always, Birmingham in 1963, which was, you know, of course, the year of, known as in civil rights history, is the year of Birmingham, the fire hose and police dog demonstrations, that, you know, probably all your listeners have seen the footage of, and then that was in the spring of 1963, Martin Luther King's massive demonstrations, and then that was followed in the fall by the church bombing I mentioned earlier of the 16th Street Baptist Church, which killed four black girls. And the conventional wisdom, or the propaganda, if you will, among white people at the time, was that King was an outside agitator. He had come in and stirred up the quote colored people who loved their lives in Birmingham. And then when he left, he just, you know, everything kind of went back to normal, sort of. And
So people essentially believe that African Americans in Birmingham were completely content with the way they were expected to live until
King
came along.
I remember we called them, you know, our colored people were happy until King came in, which was, of course, not the truth. We had one of the most courageous and important leaders of the Civil Rights Movement in Birmingham, Fred Shuttlesworth, who was sort of the hero of Carry Me Home. I remember I was reading a very short account of the 63 demonstrations and learned that there had been one white man, white businessman in Birmingham, who agreed to negotiate with King and the civil rights leaders. And he said he would do it on behalf of the other of the business community and allow his name to be used, and they didn't have to identify themselves. And his name was Sid Smyer, and I remember I screamed my empty apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That's my cousin. I had grown up with his grandson, who was also named Sid Smyer. Had been in my class with this very small class of private school kids that, in a school in Birmingham that had been founded to avoid desegregation. In the what they used to call the mess at Little Rock when that was desegregated, and the 101st Airborne had to go into to enforce the court order. But anyway, so that was kind of my awakening to the at that point I was in my late 20s and quite liberal and but I had just even though I had just never really looked at Birmingham as sort of a chapter in history that I had lived through in any meaningful way, and that's what started the journey back.
Diane McWhorter is my guest. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning book is called Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. She'll be in town at the Dallas Humanities and Institute of Humanities and Culture's Martin Luther King Symposium on Monday the 19th. I guess we should step back a minute and talk about the economy in Birmingham in the 1950s and 60s. Steel was a big industry.
Yes. Birmingham was the sort of the heavy manufacturing mecca of the Deep South. As a result of that, as of about 1907, it had become a fiefdom largely of U.S. Steel, the U.S. Steel Corporation, which was, of course, based in Pittsburgh. Birmingham was its southern colony, which at one point, it could, in terms of resources and size, it could have been the tail wagging the dog of U.S. Steel, but U.S. Steel always kept Birmingham running at minimal capacity in a way so that it wouldn't compete with the flagship in Pittsburgh. But anyway, as a result of the steel industry, there was this kind of progressive tradition of organized labor that was butting up against an equally adamant anti-union movement. And it was out of these two strands that grew, on one hand, the civil rights movement, and on the other hand, the segregationist resistance. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't just a continuity of you know, issues. It was actually the same characters. Bull Connor, who was the notorious police commissioner, an elected official of Birmingham, who sicked the fire hoses and police dogs on the child demonstrators in Birmingham, had actually been installed in City Hall in 1937 in Birmingham as this kind of anti-New Deal mascot. The rich people had been a baseball announcer, very popular, and was kind of a hick, you know, Cracker Barrel. I know that Texas had a sort of equivalent in Pappy O'Daniel. And anyway, he was sort of a sop to the masses, if you will, who was doing the bidding of the powerful politicians and lawyers in the state, or in particularly the city.
So there are motivations to keep things the way they are, in part because the white people of Birmingham are really getting rich off the backs of black labor.
Exactly. Well, they used because of the labor force in Birmingham was black and white. Even when unionization became inevitable, they could keep the unions very weak by inflaming strife between black and white workers. So there was usually the CIO, for example, they call the N-word union, and then the companies would encourage the white workers to join competing unions, which were effectively a company union. So that's how they control that. So it was really it was really, segregation was really sort of the cornerstone of the industrial profits. But then what you have, what happens in the 50s, is that the service economy starts sort of slowly supplanting this heavy manufacturing economy, and image is very important in that. And you can't just muscle your way through to profit. So the white business community starts realizing that they can't get businesses to locate in Birmingham. So it's at this point that the civil rights movement is heating up in Alabama. You've got the Montgomery bus boycott taking place throughout 1956. You have Authorine Lucy, who is the first black student at the University of Alabama. There's a riot that greets her matriculation at Alabama, and then Eisenhower doesn't enforce the court order, so she's expelled, and you know, all this stuff is happening in Alabama in particular, and the business establishment is finally realizing that this climate that they created, not only through the anti-union efforts, but they also, you know, they had support, the Klan had been basically their vigilantes to enforce this the status quo, this racist status quo, and now the Klan is starting to give everybody a bad name, and they can't, you know, they can't attract business because people don't want to come to a place where there's, where the parks may close if they're desegregated, or if schools may the public school system may shut down. So so then that sort of sets the stage for this epic confrontation in Birmingham in 1963.
Yeah, and ultimately there's this strange sort of partnership between the people at the upper echelons of white power in Birmingham and then the people sort of at the bottom, both of whom are united by maybe different motivations for their racism.
Right, and you see this today in politics and your illustrious citizen Karl Rove in politics, where you try to find common cultural ground between the rich and the poor, so that you enlist them in this kind of fraternity, at the, you know, brotherhood, sisterhood, or whatever of around cultural things in common. So in the South, for years, it was white supremacy. So the rich people were, you know, I guess one of the things that did surprise me when I started doing my research was how active they were in fomenting the strife through propaganda, through paid, for want of a better word, agitators. I mean, they had spies in the workforce to sort of go up to workers and say, how your Negro brothers coming along, and just to sort of, you know, to fan this kind of insecurity. And what you see with all, you know, in all the cultural wars, is that you have to strike people at their core identity. So you see things like the anti-gay marriage thing striking people at their sexual identity. You see racism striking people at their racial identity, and they have a very emotional response that enables them to really vote against their, you know, or against their economic self-interest. So the rich white people in Alabama and in the entire South learned very early to, right after the Civil War, that in order to prevent poor whites and blacks from organizing across the color line on the basis of their common class interests, that they had to, enlist the poor whites in this brotherhood of white supremacy, and that's what they did.
Diane McWhorter is my guest. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning book is called Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. She'll be in town on the 19th to speak to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's Martin Luther King Symposium. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Diane McWhorter. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning book is now available in paperback. That's what we're talking about today. It's called Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Did white people in Birmingham spend a lot of mental energy justifying to themselves the system of apartheid that they had set up?
That's an interesting question. I would say yes and no. That partly it was just sort of accepted. I mean, the sense of entitlement was, probably one was born with that. But on the other hand, one thing that struck me was two things. One is that I was struck by the fact that Christian gentleman is sort of had become a synonym for a bigot. And whenever somebody would criticize somebody for arguing a law, creating a law that discriminated against black people or something, the comeback would always be, "Oh no, he's a fine Christian gentleman," and that really struck me that there was some kind of confession implicit in that. And the other thing I noticed since my book came out, and I've gone around the country to Dallas next week when I'm coming there, talking to people about my experiences as a young white segregationist, and people always come up to me and want to tell me about the individual kindnesses that they would do to their family employees, their domestic employees, and I realized that people did feel like they had to do something to preserve their humanity in the midst of the system. It's an interesting combination of both. We're entitled to feel this way, but also we treat them better than the system would dictate.
What is it like for you to think back on your childhood and think about people that you must remember with some fondness, knowing that a significant portion of the adults in your life were serious racists?
Well, the sort of emotional impetus for my writing the book was to try to figure out why my father was basically so weird, and he was a really good example of someone who was quite offensive, in the way he talked about blacks. I never saw him mistreat an African American, but he was so sort of foolishly. I remember when we would watch pro football on every Sunday, that was kind of a ritual in my household. We were all Green Bay Packer fans in the 60s, and we'd be watching pro football, and he would say, even when after there was a significant number of black players, he would always say that, there would never be a black quarterback, and because they didn't have, they were only capable of rote memory. So I had to put up with all that kind of stuff. Every Southerner understands this, that you do love people who you find offensive, morally offensive, in really profound ways. So I guess that was sort of I know that in my 20s I had in college I had this rather painful rupture with my father, but that was mostly over the Vietnam War. It was more over that than over race. In my 20s, I felt like I had to convince him or change him or educate him. And then in my 30s, I thought, no, just take notes, just bear witness. So hence the book. So that came to be my attitude in a way toward the unreconstructed white people that I was around, and some of whom were my closest relatives and I adored in most ways. And I thought, okay, you're just take notes. you're not going to change them. It's not, and it's not your job. But your job is to report how people once felt in this democracy.
And your father, for one, would sort of hint to you that he had a lot of involvement with the Klan.
He did. We would find Klan literature in his office sometimes. One of the mysteries of him is that he actually, I don't want to give the book away, but he actually was more, he kind of kept me on the string. It was like sort of like Scheherazade telling me stories and about what he had done, but he was always really vague, and I kept trying to pin him down on his activities. He would tell us when I was growing up that he was going out to, and I mean, ironically, he called them civil rights meetings, and which I, you know, thought might be Klan meetings, and so he kind of at the end was telling me he was starting to disappoint me that he really wasn't involved in that much stuff. I think my worst fear was that didn't really think that he would have been capable of doing something like bomb a church or do any violence. But I guess my worst fear was that he may have known about it or heard about it and maybe thought it was going to happen. And there were all sorts of competing theories about whether that bomb, which went off during Sunday school hours on a Sunday morning, was supposed to have, whether the delaying mechanism on it worked, misfired because they think the bomb was planted at around 2 in the morning, and you know, some people say that it was supposed to go off earlier when the church was unoccupied, and some people think that it was that they were actually hoping to take out more people.
This was the one where four little girls died in that attack.
This is when the four girls died. Yeah, at 16th Street Baptist Church. That was sort of, you know, the painful childhood thing I was trying to revisit. In reconstructing as much as I could of what he was doing, and then as a journalist, I had been working as a journalist in Boston for years when I took this on, and I just wanted to find out why that church bombing hadn't been solved. There, in 1977, one of the bombers had been prosecuted by a very liberal attorney general in Alabama, Bill Baxley, but the suspects had been identified within a couple of weeks within about a month of the bombing, and they were in FBI files. So I just wondered how they could have gotten away with it all those years, and I wanted to sort of answer that question and, you know, solve the church bombing. Coincidentally, I was never thought this would happen. Right before the book was coming out, the last two living suspects were arrested, and they ultimately went on trial a year apart, right as the book was coming out.
Some of your interviews for the book caused you to go and talk to people who had been Klan members or said they were former Klan members. How did you sort of steel yourself to sit across the room from someone and talk to them about this?
Well, it was I had kept this list of all the Klansmen. I had just a gazillion lists of sources and charts and graph paper, tried to connect everybody to their events. And so I had this working list of Klansmen, and I put it off. I worked on this book for 19 years, and I think it was finally in the started working on it. I got that contract in 1982, and I think it wasn't until the mid 90s that I finally went and talked to the Klansmen. I did put it off, but every time I would go down to Birmingham, I would check in the city directory or in the phone book to see if they were still there and to see if they had moved. And so what I did was I went to the city directory, which tells you where people live, but they also tell you whether they're married and whether they have a job. And so I figured if they were married and held a job, that they may not be complete sociopaths. So in a couple of cases, I went to either ex-wives or ex-girlfriends to try to get a read on whether they were dangerous. And so then finally I knew that I could call them up and that they would refuse to talk to me, and that, you know, then I could have said, as journalists do, refuse to comment. But I knew that if I actually wanted to talk to them, I would have to just make a cold call. So that's what I did. So I got in my car and drove up to their houses and kind of hyperventilated in the car and did some silent screams before I went in and just couldn't believe I was doing it. And you know, knocked on the door, and there were only a couple who just refused to talk to me. And I actually had sort of mixed feelings about, for some reason, people tell me a lot, and I kind of was afraid they might admit something to me that they would regret later, and that they might come and go after my family once I had safely, you know, absconded back to the Northeast. And so I, you know, and nobody ever did, but I also, because they were characters in the book at that point, I wanted just to know who they were as human beings. And I found that, you know, my training as a journalist, but I did a lot of sort of historian work and archives and stuff. And what I found was that if I talked to somebody, the story changed about, you know, maybe it didn't change 180 degrees, but it changed about probably 40 degrees. So it was always, you know, essential for me to talk to the players if they were still alive. And there was just no doubt that I was going to have to go talk to the Klansmen in order to really get the story the best I could.
And at least one individual, Thomas, I believe his name was, expressed what seemed to you to be regret over what had happened.
Well, he, you know, I mean, what was weird about the Klansmen is that, and my father was like this to a certain extent, too. Once segregation fell as a result of Birmingham in 1963, the Civil Rights Act of 64, which abolished segregation, was inspired by the events of Birmingham, you know, people, it wasn't as, it just wasn't, you know, people were predicting race wars and the end of civilization as we knew it. And, you know, we can talk about why that didn't happen. But for example, Robert Thomas, who had been the exalted cyclops of this really violent clavern of the Ku Klux Klan that did most of the racial mayhem in Birmingham, he now worked for he had a black boss. And he worked for the railroad, and he said he was worried about me being in his book because he didn't want his black boss to find out. And I'm sure an element of that was that he didn't want to get in trouble, but I almost felt like he didn't want to hurt his feelings or something. So I think that once things changed and it seemed so natural, and as your listeners know, I mean, in the South, what Northerners don't know, don't quite understand, is that they don't understand that blacks and whites were together all the time, in close proximity all the time, even during segregation. So it wasn't as if you were around, you know, the races were around each other for the first time at all. So, you know, and so I think they kind of couldn't believe what all the trash they were talking back then. And my father would say things to me like, well, I never had anything against black people. We were really fighting the federal government, or we were fighting communism. And in these church bombing trials I mentioned in 2001 and 2, you know, all the Klan witnesses got up there and said they had never harbored any ill will whatsoever toward black people. You know, they were fighting the FBI or the federal government. And finally, one of the defense lawyers for one of the bombers said, sort of scratched his head and said, you know, somebody should have told Martin Luther King that his job would have been a lot easier if he had only known that my client, you know, the church bomber, was the only segregationist in Birmingham, because you couldn't find anybody at that point who would admit to being a racist. I'm not quite sure. I'm sure there's a psychological explanation for this kind of denial, but it's almost like they didn't recognize their former selves in a certain way.
Well, it's extraordinary, you know, hearing that and reading the book about really the power of culture, I guess, for good and for bad. And it's not to say that people are entirely genuine today when they don't remember being a racist, but the fact that things have changed to the extent that you know, the former cyclops of the Klan doesn't want anyone to know that he had racist ties.
Right, and his grandson, his daughter was over there when I happened to go over, and his grandson had been out in the yard when I came up, and he was so sweet, and when he came in while we were talking, and I quickly asked the daughter if he knew anything about this. And she sort of shook her head, like, don't get into it. And it turned out he was going to nursing school. So I thought, man, the grandson of this Klansman is going to be a nurse. And then I ran into some instances of real upward mobility where one of the sons of one of the big Klansmen was a lawyer. And, of course, his family was, you know, having a cow because he had a law practice now, and now his father is going to be named in this book as one of the probably unindicted co-conspirators in the church bombing. So there was a lot of it is really weird. There's a Harvard social scientist named I think it was Thomas Pettigrew, who did some studies in the early 50s, I believe. Some of this was leading up to the Brown decision, and he said that it's really conforming behavior doesn't really say a lot about people. So if you're a segregationist when segregation is the law, doesn't really say that much, that most people will go along with the law. And it's the people on the extremes who are either like the abolitionists or the Klansmen who are, you know, kind of off the bell curve. But most people will just go along with whatever the law says, and that's what I think you mean by culture, how influential culture is in people's behavior and even their beliefs.
Do you feel any guilt at all about having grown up in that environment?
I was 11 when the Civil Rights Act of 64 was passed. So, and I sort of think that's when you have to deform your conscience in a way in order to go along with this. I think that's sort of the age of political awareness in a certain way. So I think that never really got to that point, and certainly had no responsibility. But I think, I know people 10 years older than I am who were in college, say, at the time of the movement, feel really guilty about not being participants in it, white people, white Southerners.
Diane McWhorter is my guest. We're talking about her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You can see Diane on the 19th, Monday, at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's Martin Luther King Symposium.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize winner Diane McWhorter. We're talking about her book, Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. It is available now in paperback. Diane will be appearing on Monday, January 19th at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's Martin Luther King Symposium. You can learn more about that at dallasinstitute.org or on the Think page of KERA. Let's go to the phones now and speak to Jack in Dallas. Hello, Jack.
Hi. I grew up about the same time as the author, and when the public television show Eyes on the Prize came out, and I saw the films of demonstrators being attacked by dogs and fire hoses, it just made me remember seeing those when I was a child and accepting that at the time. And I'm from the North. I mean, this attitude that she was talking about wasn't restricted to the South.
So you just saw it and thought that's just the way things are.
Well, as a child,
yeah.
Seeing them when I was seeing them now, I mean, how could we possibly have put up with that? But that's the way it was.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, so you mean you thought that this was just sort of an appropriate response what's funny is that growing up, I mean, people always refer to that, to those demonstrations as the riots, and they still do that. It's almost like they didn't differentiate between a highly organized, a Gandhian campaign of direct action and a riot. So I don't know whether that's sort of partly what you're getting at, that it was just sort of considered, some spontaneous uprising that had to be put down. Now, speaking of the organization of the demonstrations, I just want to mention that, and I I bow to him. I'm also appearing at the Institute on Monday is going to be Wyatt T. Walker, who was Martin Luther King's chief of staff at the time of the Birmingham demonstrations, and he is one of the living legends of the civil rights era. He is brilliant, an incredible speaker. He was the tactician who was the sort of chief of the field marshal of the Birmingham demonstrations. Trying to mapping the routes of the marches, behind the scenes negotiating. Very mischievous. Did a lot of things where he would say, I don't believe I told Dr. King that. Anyway, I hope so. I feel even guilty waiting so late to bring him up in the show because he really is incredible. He had an amazing career in New York after he left the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of which he was the executive director. Really turned it into a professional, big budget operation when he took over in 1960. So I just wanted to mention Wyatt T. Walker is also going to be in Dallas on Monday.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought him up. And I guess the way the event works is that there will be some presentations, and then there will be a panel discussion. Then the audience will get to ask questions of both of you.
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I'm gonna give a talk, and then Walker and I are gonna have a conversation. And I'm hoping he'll be able to do some real preaching because he's an amazing speaker, and I will not be following him. Thank God, I will be preceding him.
I want to talk to you for a minute. You talked about 11 being the age of sort of political awareness, at least for you. And I know that you've done some writing for older children. This is something I'm a parent as myself, and it's always great when you can find work written for children that does try to tell them the whole truth without sort of varnishing things and oversimplifying things. Was that, because you're a mother, was that an easy balance for you, or was it something that you struggled with to get the tone just right when you've written for kids?
I wrote this children's book called A Dream of Freedom, which is sort of a survey of the movement, and I really felt the need for that when watching my daughters grow up, because one of the probably unintended consequences of the Martin Luther King holiday is that kids as young as in nursery school are commemorating that now, and so. I remember seeing the impression my kids were getting of the civil rights movement was so bizarre because they couldn't even describe to them what segregation was. Because first of all, it's just so troubling when you to even tell a young child who is developing is sort of trying to make sense of the world if this even occurred. Because then you don't even want them to ask the question. Why were they mistreated? You get the sort of Rosa Parks version initially, and so they think that all it was that black people had to sit at the back of the bus, and probably in most communities, most people don't even ride buses. I mean, in New York, people where my kids grew up, people do happen to ride the bus, so at least they had a visual image of what that would be like. But so to me, it was really. They just got this really sanitized version of it, and then the thing that really sort of set me off and was my daughter got a Scholastic News in I think second grade at the time of the King holiday, and the Scholastic News referred to King. He was like this kind of human resources facilitator. It was like he taught people that you can resolve differences without fighting, and I thought. No, it was a fight. I mean, on the black side, it was nonviolent, but unfortunately, it was not so nonviolent on the white side.
It wasn't like everybody had to get the memo that you're supposed to be respectful of every other human being.
Exactly, and then the other thing was they referred to the segregationists, which I don't even think they even named called segregationists, those who disagreed with him. So again, it's this kind of moral relativism. It's like, oh, it's not like anybody was really wrong. They just disagreed, and sort of why can't we all get along? So I thought, oh my God, these kids are just growing up with such a warped version of this. And so then I thought, yeah, they really need to know how bad it was, and also you can't really appreciate what the movement accomplished unless you realize how bad it was. And the children's book does go into quite a bit about how segregation worked and the violent resistance to the movement and everything. So it was interesting to write. And I have to say, Scholastic published it, and they didn't. I was afraid they were going to try to dial it back because they because it might be too upsetting. But they did not, to their credit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Diane McWhorter. Let's go next to C in Wichita Falls. Hi, C.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Real quickly, and I appreciate you taking my call, I'd like to make a statement, first of all, to say how has her book and the way she's lived her life and the research that she's conducted affected her life?
Diane?
Oh wow! I couldn't even begin to cover that, in the 5 minutes we have left or something. But it just profoundly changed the way I look at the world. I have a way of being in the world now that I never thought possible. My relationship with Fred Shuttlesworth, who was the leader in Birmingham, who was probably the most important figure besides King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, is the fact that to have the gift of being able to write about him and to have gotten to know him well, and he's still alive, he's ailing now. He was going to be in Dallas on Monday as well, but he has suffering complications from a stroke, so he wasn't able to make it. Just made me feel so grateful, that I could sort of end up literally on the same page as him, in this children's book, for example. But also to understand the darkness of the human heart, to the way in which ordinary people like me, the white people I grew up with, are capable of such inhumanity. That's a lesson that I think of every single day as I watch what's going on in the world. My new book has a Nazi Germany component in it. It's also set in Alabama, but it starts out in Germany. To understand how power works and what it will do to preserve itself and to sort of afflict the powerless is just a lesson that I wouldn't have given up for anything.
Diane, to what extent does Birmingham today see itself as a unified place? Is it still socially, if not legally, segregated?
It's funny because I would say that socially, I always say that I love going to interracial gatherings in Birmingham because it's all the cool people in town, and so, yeah, so there's certain pockets of it that are very, very integrated and sort of the progressive, politically progressive people. The people in my age group now are kind of running the city, and a lot of them are really progressive. And as the movement proved, it doesn't take a majority to make things change. It just takes a very vocal, smart, enlightened minority, because the civil rights movement itself was definitely a minority of African Americans. It's still probably in the main. It's still socially segregated. The workplaces. The cliche is that the races are very comfortable working together, but they don't go have dinner together. But there's a very visible black middle class in Birmingham, especially around city government. So, if I were raising a black child, I would say that there were a lot of very visible role models in Birmingham that would. I would be happy for my child to have. And So it's, yeah, it's you know, I have kind of a skewed, you know, skewed view of it probably because the people I see are pretty much pretty integrated. I'm going. In fact, I'm going to Birmingham for Inauguration Day, and I'm going to an inaugural ball there at the Civil Rights Institute. So, when I'm sure that's going to be. I'm sure all the cool people will be there.
So, are we reaching a time in our history when we view the civil rights movement as American history as opposed to African American history?
Well, yeah, especially doing this book, I could never quite understand why, and I would hear this a lot from Black scholars in particular. They just felt like their field was such a was kind of segregated from the rest of American history, and I never quite understood that because I just felt that that narrative is at the core of our history. It was the founding. Original sin. Slavery was the original sin of our country. It remains today, you know, up to January 20th. It's still, you know, at the top of the agenda of the sort of the national political conversation. So I never really understood that. And to me, it's also, you know, then we have the Civil War, and then the great domestic conflict of the 20th century, the Civil Rights Movement. So I never quite understood why it would be not anything less than just central to our narrative. And I think also that our country is so, it really is exceptional in that it was founded on this principle of equality. I mean, I don't know of any other countries that were founded on that. And that what has forced us to keep trying for this more perfect union is our legacy of slavery, you know, that it obviously wasn't perfect. And it's really forced us to work out all these, I mean, this sounds kind of Pollyanna-ish, but that's sort of the gift of it, that it has forced us to blaze all these trails in, you know, human advancement and you know, opportunity and everything that set up an example to the rest of the world. So I just think it's, yeah, I mean, I think it's just an amazing gift and burden at the same time. And that's how I came to look at Birmingham, that, you know, that it was, yes, a place where terrible things had happened, but it also produced this incredible uprising of democratic uprising of African Americans who gave the country its promise back to it, you know, and made us make good on our birthright.
Diane McWhorter's Pulitzer Prize-winning book is called Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama. She will appear on Monday, January 19th, at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's Martin Luther King Symposium, along with the Reverend Wyatt T. Walker. Diane, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.